Hey, it's Cameron here. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I'd recommend checking out Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast. Head over to aka.ms/public-sector-future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts. Hi, and welcome to Ones and Twos, FP's economics podcast. Every week we take a couple data points, use them to try to explain the world. I'm Cameron Abadi, FP's deputy editor with you in Berlin, Germany. As always, Adam Twos, FP's economics columnist and Columbia University professor, is with us in Singapore. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Cam.
So in the second half of the show, we are going to be continuing our series, the long COVID series, we're calling it, on the after effects of the COVID pandemic. We'll be talking about the effect specifically on the global economy. So stick around for that. But first, we wanted to do another data point, and that is 5%, which is the growth target that China's government recently announced for the country.
Stability and transforming its economy will continue to be a priority, with a GDP growth target of around 5% set for the year ahead. Chinese Premier Li Qiang made these announcements.
China's premier is acknowledging the GDP target will, quote, not be an easy reach, alluding to potentially more government intervention as the country works to combat a slew of issues such as a property crisis, deflation, and...
That surprised many analysts in the West who have been concerned by the various kinds of headwinds China is facing, from a real estate bubble that seemingly burst to structural shifts in the global economy away from globalization. Some even suggest that the 5% target isn't to be trusted at all, that it's the result of Beijing fudging its own numbers. What's not in dispute is that the Chinese economy is facing a major rebalancing, that after a historically rapid rise, the country needs to change some of its economic foundations to keep the rise going in the future. That's what many seem to believe. So we thought we'd dig into this big rebalancing act that China is facing. So Adam, first off, the Chinese real estate boom, that does seem to be over pretty definitively. Now that the tide has gone out, what exactly has been left behind? I mean, what is the current status of the Chinese real estate market? Is there a lot of excess inventory now sitting around, empty apartments, that kind of thing? Is the government also, for its part, directly intervening in the market? What does it look like overall?
Yeah, I think it's important to get the scale of the Chinese real estate crash in perspective, and to be precise also about why this is happening. I mean, this is the driver of the largest growth boom in human history, the urbanization of China, the urbanization of hundreds of millions of people in the course of a generation, the creation of a private property system of a gigantic scale, really second, well, it depends how you estimate it, actually, and by some counts, it's even larger than the real estate sector in the United States. It accounted for about 20% of Chinese economic activity at its peak, just the real estate sector. And it didn't die a natural death. It didn't die of natural causes. It was deliberately pricked by the Chinese government with a series of measures deliberately designed to deflate the bubble. So it's the largest, most spectacular, deliberate act of counter-cyclical economic policy the world has ever seen. So it's important to say this isn't just a bubble that burst. It was deliberately deflated. It's spectacular in its consequences across China, and the scale of the overhang of residential floor space that's not sold is gigantic. By some estimates, it's 5 billion square meters, so that would be 50 billion square feet at the end of 2023. That's enough for hundreds of millions of people to live in. It's a gigantic amount of space that isn't rapidly clearing. One of the most serious parts of this problem are the large number of apartments which are part paid for and part finished. And finishing those is crucial to restoring confidence in the system overall. it hangs over China like a dark cloud because real estate is the major source of private wealth. It's the major place in which people store their wealth. The government has been, on the one hand, deliberate in bringing this down. It has not intervened on the gigantic sort of nervous reflex, a nervous knee-jerk kind of way in which one might expect a government to react to a crisis this large. They've actually been quite slow. They've allowed real estate developers like Evergrande to actually go under, really heading towards bankruptcy and dismantling. What we are seeing, though, are policies pursued at various different levels. I mean, China's gigantic, 1.4 billion people, to speak of government policy often misses the mark when what we're talking about is provincial level policy. And in many cities in China, it's actually forbidden to mark the price of apartments down. Doesn't stop it happening, but it means it happens off the books in various types of discount. There have been efforts to stimulate mortgage lending. But I think the important point to make here is that the regime deliberately induced this downturn and is showing a considerable amount of cold-bloodedness in allowing it to work its way through. So we're not seeing the rapid, as it were, pullback that you'd expect from a policy that is having such a dramatic and very negative effect.
Yeah, it does seem like real estate was a centerpiece of what people call this investment-based growth model that China has had in recent years, and that's been responsible for its big boom. But the conventional wisdom is that China needs to shift to a more consumption-based economy, you know, after years of relying on investment-based growth and also export-based growth. So, I mean, I'm curious, what sort of precedents are there for successfully pulling off that kind of fundamental pivot? I mean, are there other places that have had sudden booms in consumption on the scale that really would be necessary here to make up for the other declines in investment and exports that people are talking about here?
I think when we talk about this kind of pivot, the question really is, what's our standard of success? I mean, the most radical shifts from non-consumption activity to consumption activity in the Western world have happened in the aftermath of wars. So if you think about the aftermath of World War I, or the world, which gave then rise to the Roaring Twenties, or the aftermath of World War II, which witnessed the gigantic growth boom of the 1950s and 60s, you see there a swap from military activity and investment to private consumption and private investment, which was the driver of remarkable growth. And you could think of that as an example, but of course the expenditure in wartime was a kind of consensual decision to move away from consumption, and consumption just snapped back. So the consumption habits were there all along. You could think of another moment, which you could describe in much less successful terms, which would in fact be the slowdown of Western economic growth, European growth, notably in the 1970s, where investment falls off quite sharply and consumption doesn't fully make up for it. And the result is a much slower rate of growth from the 1970s and 80s onwards. That produces quite serious social crisis in the 70s and 80s and distributional struggle that's extremely painful. The example that is most commonly invoked to describe China's impasse is the example of the East Asian economies like South Korea and Japan, which had similar levels of investment to China, not quite at China's level, sustained over quite so long, but nevertheless, really quite dramatically high levels of investment. But the question here is what constitutes, how does one evaluate that slowdown in those two cases? And certainly in the Japanese case, it's often referred to as a period of lost decades, but it's lost decades at a very high level of standard of living, with a very high levels of life expectancy, rather agreeable situations in the big cities with affordable housing. In many Japanese cities, I think one could describe that as a successful kind of plateauing. And China's situation is rather different from that, in the sense that China is still a middle-income country, essentially, that there is on that basis still quite a lot of growing to be done. And consumption is, in fact, rising in China and has been since the early 2000s. So China's consumption share has gone from as low as 30 to 40% of GDP in the early 2000s, when investment and export were really doing all of the work in powering Chinese growth, to a much higher share of consumption in overall economic activity now, closer to 60, 65%. Exports playing a smaller part, investment continuing to be a major driver of growth. So I think in the Chinese case, the emphasis has got to be on continuing growth. 5% per annum growth is still a very rapid rate. But what the regime really needs to induce is not so much a less investment and more consumption as different types of investment, and above all, investment in population, in human capital, in education, in health, in various types of welfare. I think the best way to regard all of that kind of spending is not simply as consumption, but as investment. And the other areas are going to be things like renewable energy. So I think the Chinese model doesn't really conform to any obvious historical precedent. The growth has been too dramatic. It's still too incomplete at the national level. And the most constructive way to look at this is to think of, as it were, investments in human capital that could be made, so the development of a welfare sector, and then on the other hand, new avenues for productive investment that will put the growth engine that China still has at its disposal to better use than redundantly building more and more infrastructure and more apartments.
I mean, when it comes to China's exports and the boom in exports that it experienced, it seems like a lot of that had to do with its status as a low-cost manufacturing environment, that's what made it the factory floor of the world in many ways. And I'm wondering whether that's still true. I mean, have wages been rising in China to an extent that would make it no longer a low-cost environment for manufacturing and makes that kind of export model no longer as plausible?
So the what matters crucially for exports, for the so-called question of competitiveness, is not so much wage cost per se, but unit labor costs. So the balance or the combination of the wage that's paid and the productivity of the work that is compensated with the wage. And China, decades ago in the 1980s and 1990s, offered a combination of quite low productivity, but even lower wages. And that was, you know, the period where in the 1970s, 1980s, Chinese wages were like 3% of the American wage level. Productivity was also a fraction of the US level, but the combination of that kind of dirt cheap labor and modest productivity, the Chinese labor force in the 80s already had near universal literacy and quite decent public health, so they were ready to go as a manufacturing labor force. That created a kind of irresistible attraction for the expansion of Chinese manufacturing. And really, the story since then is one of shifting away from that position in what is, generally speaking, a rather benign direction. So productivity has increased, but mercifully, and very much for the benefit of the Chinese population and, in a sense, for the world at large, Chinese wages have grown even more rapidly than productivity. So the stark advantage in unit labor costs, which drove the Chinese manufacturing story in the 1980s and 1990s, is no longer applicable in any sense at all. Chinese wages are now higher than in the vast majority of emerging markets. They are higher than in Mexico or in Thailand or in Malaysia for comparable workers. The bit of Chinese labor that tends to be a little bit cheaper is lower level supervisory white collar work, which is not paid very much more than blue collar work in China. But China's labor productivity has risen very dramatically as well as a result of investment. So China remains an attractive site for manufacturing. It hasn't priced itself out of the market compared to truly high-cost locations in the West. It is now more expensive to manufacture in China, even on a unit labor cost basis, than in much of the emerging and low-income world. But that's not why people continue to manufacture in China. It's not a pure cost argument anymore, nor is it a pure productivity argument, or rather, if it's a productivity argument, it's the sophisticated networks, it's the remarkably complicated supply chains, the externalities, the communities of production that exist in something like the Pearl River Delta in Shenzhen or something like that, or around Shanghai, that make China irresistible for global manufacturing. So it's no longer a crude cost argument, even adjusted for productivity, but productivity, labor cost, and the benefits of producing in what is, by any standard, the hub of global manufacturing.
You mentioned renewable energy as a sector of the Chinese economy that's growing, and I'm curious, what are China's prospects, say, for relying on renewable energy as a future growth model itself? I mean, like, could China become the world's renewable energy superpower? And could that be a model for its economy in the future?
I mean, it already is. I mean, the thing is that China is also the world's dirty energy superpower, at least in terms of the consumption of coal. It's overwhelmingly the largest consumer of coal, not in terms of oil and gas as a share of its energy mix, but in the dirtiest forms of fossil fuel. China set entirely new standards in the 25 years since the late 1990s. But it is also, and at the same time, and to an extent ever more so, the leader in the global energy transition, whether you're talking about solar, whether you're talking about onshore, offshore wind, in any case, in hydro, where the Chinese have a massive lead over the entire rest of the world that was built over a period of decades. China really is the place where the energy transition is happening, and not just in installed capacity, but also in the manufacturing capacity necessary to produce the solar panels, the windmills, the wind turbines, the batteries, the ultra-high voltage long-range transmission technology that's necessary to hook up the vast capacity in renewables that's being installed. I mean, China invests as much in renewable energy right now as the entire of the developed world put together. So multiples of what the Europeans and the United States are individually doing. The International Energy Agency expects 60% of the new renewable energy capacity installed by 2028 to be installed in China. 60% of the global increase in renewable energy capacity to happen in China. And it has to if this story is to have a happy end, because more than 30% of global CO2 emissions are coming in China as well. So the Chinese appear to be entirely serious about moving away from their coal-based model. There's every reason to do so because it's heavily polluting and not really as cost-efficient as renewable energy. There is a very solid regime commitment to doing it, and there are huge industrial policy competitiveness arguments for making the move ahead of everyone else on the large scale and then swamping their markets with excess Chinese capacity, which has been the Chinese export formula for many decades now. And that's exactly what we are seeing in the EV market, where the Chinese market for electric vehicles is driving the entire story. Everyone else really is a second mover. And that includes Tesla, whose crucial market is in China ultimately. So it's happening, it's a reality. The most remarkable number in some ways is that as the rest of the Chinese economy has slowed down, green energy investment has taken over. So that last year, 40% of overall economic growth in China, all in from all sources, 40% came from the green energy investment. So China became the first major economy in the world, and it is by most physical metrics by far and away the biggest economy in the world. By dollar exchange rates, it's still smaller than the US, but that's a kind of arbitrary measure that depends on the exchange rate on any given day. In terms of physical output, the Chinese economy is overwhelmingly the largest in the world, and it is also the first that has become, if you like, governed by, driven by, propelled by the green energy transition. And that's exciting, dramatic, historic, because it shifts the political economy of energy. China, of course, still has a massive rearguard action to fight against its entrenched coal interests. They have politics in China too, and those are going to rally around coal. But if you've got 40% of growth being driven by your clean energy coalition, then that's a powerful driving and forcing wedge for further change to further improve the conditions for that sector to grow. So with any luck, and it really is a matter, I think, really it should be a matter of global anticipation and optimism that in China this balance is shifting. It leaves everyone else in the dust, and frankly, we have no one to blame but ourselves.
And I mean, just to clarify, when it comes to this leadership position that China is now assumed on renewable energy, I mean, does that place them in a position that is sort of analogous geopolitically to the big oil producers during the fossil fuel industrial era? I mean, is this a really kind of geopolitical power that China has now earned for itself that it can use?
I don't think so, because this is a red herring, a canard that's often floated by the more hawkish anti-China lobby right now, which is to say that importing Chinese photovoltaic panels is like importing Russian gas, which is nonsense, of course, because once you've got the Chinese photovoltaic panel, it sits there and generates electricity from the sun. The Chinese aren't involved at any stage beyond that. It's absolutely not like an LNG delivery from the US or a gas pipeline from Russia, which can be switched off at any given moment. Once you've bought the kit, it's yours. Of course, it has to be maintained, and you're going to have to replace some of them in due course. But it doesn't give China that kind of leverage. But it does give them technological lead. It does make them the supplier of choice for cheap equipment. And it does mean that as the poorer and middle-income world begins to develop and choose green energy, it'll be pretty damn hard to convince them to get that equipment from anywhere but China. And that will be experienced by the West, I think, in a sort of level of geopolitics is going to be experienced as a real challenge. I would argue that the level of meaning, if you like, in the sense of, you know, political leadership on this issue, which liberals around the Western world define as theirs, which is climate, it is profoundly difficult for them to adjust to a reality in which the true hero of this transition is going to be China's CCP-led state capitalist, whatever we're going to call it, hybrid economy.
So finally, I wanted to ask about a phenomenon I've seen a fair amount of talk about, namely China's RUN movement, that is R-U-N, the English, or drawn from the English word run. And that's referring to a phenomenon of young Chinese people fleeing China or leaving China, I guess to use a more neutral term, for more freedoms elsewhere, including the United States. I'm curious of whether there's data that shows this is a statistically significant phenomenon. And then, even statistics aside, I'm curious whether this recognizable movement suggests something deeper that might be wrong with China's economy. I mean, could there be an erosion of legitimacy of some kind on the level of ideology simply?
Yes, I mean, this is a fascinating phenomenon. It's part of a recurring phenomenon of the Chinese internet, that memes like this, ideas, themes acquire huge momentum and then gather steam at a remarkable pace. So there was 996, which was a protest movement against the extraordinary excessive hours in Chinese workplaces, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., 6 days a week. That's a 72-hour week. So 996 became a slogan of a kind of protest movement. Then there was the idea of lying flat, which had more to do with, if you like, dropping out of established career paths. The runology movement really gathered pace. We can time it quite precisely to the moment on April 3rd, 2022, when the government reiterated its dynamic zero COVID policy, which basically set the stage for the draconian shutdown in Shanghai. And there was a huge surge in internet searches on WeChat about themes around immigration, and then, you know, particularly migration to Canada, apparently, which saw a 2,846% increase between March 28th and April 3rd in 2022. That was, you know, testing the limits of the Chinese internet. And so this code word was adopted, which in fact, the characters in Chinese apparently spell the word moist, but if you transliterate them into English, it spells R-U-N. So this became this kind of code for a conversation, really, you're right, I think, about the terms of life in a society which could be subject to the kind of draconian, dramatic, sudden, capricious kind of lockdown that the Xi regime was not imposing for the entire time of COVID, right? This is a Western legend. China was locked down hard in the spring of 2020, and then no longer in the summer of 2020. There were open-air parties and pool parties in Wuhan. But then as Omicron spread in the spring of 2022, the regime attempted to control it with the same old methods, and they didn't work. So they went to this dynamic optimization strategy, which ended in fiasco. And it's that really which has triggered this more broad perception that somehow if you continue living and trying to make a life in Xi Jinping's China, you are subject to a kind of capricious and draconian control regime. And it is it's a phenomenon, I think, of relatively highly educated Chinese on the whole, folks who are looking for a life which will be more self-determined. There is a migration flow out of China, a variety of different flows, notable to the United States, going on right now. Runology is not principally focused on the US, because the US is no longer perceived as terribly welcoming for that kind of migrant. The United States is the destination for at least two considerable migrant streams right now. One are asylum claimants, people who are suffering political persecution or religious persecution, and Chinese applications for asylum in the United States have surged to six-figure levels, and they're relatively successful. And the other that's been really grabbing headlines, which comes from a very different kind of source, is economic migration on the whole through Latin America and Central America to the Mexican border. And there's an entire set of schemes, agencies in China, which will sell you a plane ticket to Ecuador, which is one of the places you can travel to without a visa as a Chinese. And then you can make your way by hook or by crook to the Mexican border. There are more expensive programs which will take you straight to Mexico. In the Chinese middle class, these kind of trips are $5,000 to $15,000 a head, can afford this kind of push. And it's folks who are kind of stuck in the Chinese economic model and looking for a way out. And we're talking about tens of thousands of people on that route. But the crucial thing with China is just simply to understand the scale of the country and the implications of that for migration. Right? So Britain, I use that as a benchmark. So Britain is a society with a relatively large flux. It has about a million plus people that enter the country. So that's about 2% of the population, slightly less every year. And it has about 600,000 Brits that leave every year. So that's about 1% of the population. Now, if you apply that kind of level of mobility to China, it would imply an influx of 30 million people and an outflow of 14 million. And so the kind of, as soon as you say that, it becomes obvious that nothing even remotely like that is going on through any channel. The total number of people of Chinese origin born in China currently resident in the United States is in the order of 2.5 to 3 million. So that's a tiny fraction of the kind of migration you would expect if Chinese were moving as much as typical Europeans, certainly Brits, move in any given year. So really, we shouldn't exaggerate any of these flows in the Chinese context. China's such a large society that you'll find significant numbers of people willing to try practically any kind of wheeze, any kind of investment scheme. There's 1.4 billion highly active internet reading folks, and they can be gained and won over for virtually any scheme. And some of those involve these long-range migration stories. But we are not talking about a vast wave of migration, anything comparable to the kind of refugee flows that we're familiar from the Middle East or something like that, not even remotely close. The vast majority of Chinese, if they migrate, migrate within China, and a small, tiny minority leave for a variety of different reasons, of which the runology types are a relatively small fraction, much as one, you know, can sympathize with the horror, really, of those lockdowns in 2022. It's as yet a relatively modest phenomenon.
Yeah, that is a useful clarification. I mean, I suppose the question remains whether the kind of somehow, you know, whether the cultural significance exceeds the, you know, statistical.
Oh, it definitely does. Yes. And there's no doubt also that if folks felt entirely free to make the choice, you'd have more people flowing in and out than a whole different variety of different channels. It's quite clear at this point that, you know, a decision to emigrate has quite serious consequences, potentially also for your extended family. It's not a straightforward choice. We're not talking about an East German type of regime, but it's one where you consider your migration choice quite carefully, and it can be a one-way street.
Okay, well, I'm pretty confident this won't be the last time we're talking about China. We do need to leave off here for now, but we will be back in a second to talk about COVID and the global economy.
Hey, it's Cameron here. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I've got the podcast for you. Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast features great guests like Sami Khoury, head of the Canadian Government Center for Cybersecurity, and Gulsana Mamadieva of the Ministry of Digital Transformation of Ukraine. Each episode explores the lessons of digital transformation from leaders all around the world. Head over to aka.ms/public sector future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, and welcome back. This is the third segment in our series on COVID, on the occasion of the 4-year anniversary of the COVID lockdowns in the United States. We've already covered COVID as an acute illness, also COVID's effects on the commercial real estate market in the West. This week, we want to talk about COVID and its after effects on the global economy. So yeah, let's just dive right in. Adam, the first question I wanted to ask is whether we can say, are there any countries that we could say are winners in economic terms from the pandemic? And obviously, in some sense, everyone lost out from the pandemic, but who are really the relative losers if we were to compare?
Well, it is a tricky matter to describe an event which killed so many people as you know, dividing the world into winners and losers, because as you say, at some level, we were all losers, clearly. But if you use the Economist benchmark, which is to ask yourself, where is GDP now after the pandemic in relation to where we expected GDP to be at this moment before the pandemic? So if you take 2019 projections for where GDP was going to be in 2023 and compare them to where GDP actually ended up in 2023, so if you use that rather narrow benchmark, then there's a clear answer to this question. And the answer is that the United States is the winner. It's the only big economy whose GDP in 2023 is noticeably higher than where we were anticipating it being before the pandemic. Now, it's the winner in large part because the pandemic triggered Congress into approving very large-scale fiscal policy and the Fed into very, very generous monetary policy, which sort of slingshotted the American economy through this whiplash shock in 2020 and then this very, very rapid recovery. And there's no other economy in the world which can boast a level of GDP in 23 larger than where GDP was expected to be in 23 before the pandemic. So for Europe, current GDP is 2% below where we expected it to be. For China, it's 4% below where we expected it to be. And then the real losers are the emerging market economies, which are 5% below, and the low-income developing countries are 6% below trend where they expected to be. Now, of course, it's true that all of those countries were expected to grow, certainly China, the emerging market, and low income were expected to grow quite rapidly before the pandemic. And so their shortfall is relative to that higher expectation, but it's nevertheless a very serious shortfall. And for the low income and emerging market economies, it's a truly grim outlook because their access to global capital markets essentially ended, and then their debt levels were substantially squeezed by surging interest rates, which had to be applied to stop the inflation that followed the COVID crisis. If you break this down not by country but by population slice, then you have to say it's the poorest that suffered most. And there were 70 million people more living in extreme poverty in 2020 than in 2019. That's an 11% increase. That's a larger increase than happened during the Asian financial crisis of 97-98. In fact, it's a four times larger increase. And so it's really the poorest in the poorest countries that are the losers, and the United States, consumers in particular, who are the beneficiaries of the policies triggered by the COVID crisis. Not by the crisis itself, but by the policies that the crisis triggered Congress into approving.
Well, yeah, you mentioned all that extra spending that happened by governments during the pandemic, you know, trillions in the US, but many other countries increased public spending to keep their economies afloat amid lockdowns. I'm curious whether there are any countries where all that emergency spending was more than just a temporary measure. I mean, did any durable new welfare state institutions get created anywhere in the world?
Well, there isn't any country where the fiscal balance has been restored to the pre-COVID level, nowhere. Everyone is in bigger deficit than they were before COVID, and those deficits are slowly closing in some cases. In the United States, they show no sign of closing at all. So the outlook for the US deficit is 4 to 5% of GDP going forward. The truly disappointing thing is that the United States, which has done best out of the overall path of economic growth since 2019 and has these large deficits, is not generating those deficits with a view to supporting a generous extension of the American welfare state, which was in fact adopted during the crisis. Child tax benefits, for instance, halved American child poverty during the crisis. All of that has in fact been unwound, and we're simply running an unbalanced level of general expenditure against a wholly inadequate level of tax revenue. And as a result, big deficits and big debts are piling up without any substantial structural change. And the sad story for the rest of the world is that the World Bank tracked no less than 4,000 social protection measures developed across the world in response to the crisis. There was a really dramatic extension worldwide of social protection mechanisms. Cash transfers alone reached 1.4 billion people worldwide for the first time in new ways. And yet, precisely because the recovery has been so difficult, notably for the poorest and emerging market economies, and their fiscal positions are so squeezed by higher interest rates, we have seen very little institutional legacy from this one-off dramatic extension. This isn't to say that nothing remains in the system. But I think probably the longest and most enduring legacies will not be permanent structures so much as the muscle memory of how to respond to crisis. And there, quite clearly, I think the short-time working schemes that were adopted by the Europeans in the course of the crisis and that we've spoken about on previous episodes way back when, they have remained, I think, a real learning and institutional learning, but they only apply when you're really facing very large-scale surges in unemployment. What we haven't seen is really a durable extension of comprehensive welfare anywhere, I think, of any significant extent, unfortunately.
In terms of other policy shifts, I'm curious whether the pandemic killed off the era of low interest rates. I mean, obviously, there was a period that we all got accustomed to, I think, between seemingly the great financial crisis of the 2008 period and this pandemic where the interest rates were at zero, sometimes below zero. It seemed like it could stay that way indefinitely. And now it's very much not the case, where we've all are slowly getting used to interest rates above zero again. I'm curious whether we'll look back on those zero interest rate period at that period as a kind of aberration, or do you think it could return in some form sometime soon?
I mean, I think that kind of relationship could seem apparent. I mean, interest rates are higher now and seem set to stay higher for longer than they did before the pandemic. But it's important to get the causation right and the timing in the story here, because the pandemic itself led to a new round of interest rate cuts. In fact, it stopped dead any attempts at what were called normalization, which was one of the buzzwords of 2018 and 2019. And ushered in a period of absolutely massive unconventional monetary policy, with interest rates being cut and central banks, notably the Fed, but also the ECB, piling into bond markets and buying debt at an absolutely extraordinary rate. So it wasn't the pandemic so much that shifted the pattern of unconventional monetary policy that we've been living with since 2008. It was the subsequent inflation that did, and really in a way that I think has taken many people by surprise, because there was the thesis that we had become addicted essentially to zero interest rate or even negative interest rate in Europe and Japan for a while, policy regimes, and the dependence of the economy on these low interest rates was such that it was like an addiction, and it would be, you know, insuperably painful to break this addiction. And so it would never happen. And so in the interest rates would be frozen at zero or below zero for the foreseeable future. And that isn't what's happened. As price inflation surged, even though much of the price inflation didn't appear to have very much to do with monetary causes, the central banks actually responded with the most serious and large scale, the most comprehensive increase in interest rates we've seen since the Volcker shock of the late 70s and the early 1980s. It isn't on the same scale as the Volcker shock, but then the inflation wasn't on the same scale either. It wasn't anywhere near as persistent. But nevertheless, the price of a mortgage in the United States and many other parts of the world has soared relative to the pre-COVID level. So there has been this very major shock, which has taken many bits of people by surprise. How long it will last for, I think, is a matter that we should discuss in some other episode. We've discussed it in the past as well. It's this notion of R star, what is the equilibrium rate of interest rates? And that depends a lot on the underlying health of the economy, how rapidly it's growing, and what kind of interest rate it will bear, if you like, at what rate of interest investment will still be such as to ensure a reasonable rate of growth and something approximating to full employment. And we don't really quite know that yet, I think. Currently, the United States looks fairly robust, and it seems likely that interest rates will stay at their current level or somewhat below that, but certainly well above zero for the foreseeable future. But that might not be the case everywhere. And certainly the European economy is extraordinarily anemic and doesn't really show much sign of being able to bear substantially positive interest rates. And the outlook for Japanese interest rates is just barely above zero, though it's going to break the zero mark. So I think it's a differentiated pattern, and it's too early to tell. And it looks as though the United States may see slightly higher rates for the foreseeable future than other parts of the world economy, which are less robust.
I also wanted to ask whether the number of deaths caused by the pandemic, whether that's been its own significant global economic event. I mean, is the loss of human capital through death a measurable economic phenomenon?
It is. I mean, it's a rather distasteful exercise, because the measure of human capital is generally the earning potential of the people who die. And that varies by wage, by social class. It's affected by a whole variety of factors, which mean that poorer people, people from lower social classes, have their lives valued at lower rates than people who have the good fortune to be able to earn higher salaries. It's a thoroughly distasteful exercise. And a more neutral way, possibly, of doing this kind of calculation is to ask not just how many people died, but how many life years were lost as a result of people dying. So this adjusts for age. So if somebody in their 70s dies, then you lose fewer potential life years than if somebody in their 30s dies. And that's a way, I think, of capturing the economic damage done by a pandemic like this in a way which isn't as invidious and frankly distasteful as that kind of standard calculation of the value of human life. And if you do that, there was a study done in 2021, admittedly, but as of January 2021, so this is before the big second wave of Omicron swept across the world, in 81 countries which had relatively high rates of COVID incidence at that point, 20.5 million years of life had been lost, that's of which three quarters of this loss occurred in the under 75s. So, and in the United States, though only one-fifth of recorded COVID deaths up to that point occurred in the under 65 population, that group accounted for half of the years lost. So that will be one way of making this kind of calculation. And you can then look at different social groups and see how they benefited or how they were relatively well protected. And in the UK, for instance, there's a 2-to-1 gap in terms of the life years lost between relatively affluent and less affluent neighborhoods. In the United States, inevitably on grounds of race, the gaps are absolutely enormous with the number of life years, not lives, but life years lost. So the number of younger people dying within the black population compared to the white population, it's in the order of 7-to-1 difference between the number of life years lost for black Americans compared to white Americans. Perhaps another really tragic way of estimating this impact is to look at the number of children that were orphaned by COVID. So, you know, who will suffer the lifelong impact of losing a parent early in life. And by May 2022, at least 7.5 million children in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia had been at least orphaned through the death of at least one parent by May 2022. So that's another way of gauging the scale of this shock.
What if we were to look at this question of human capital through the perspective of school lockdowns? Obviously, that was one of the most controversial policies that was designed in response to the pandemic. I'm curious whether that has led to a measurable and perhaps durable decline in global human capital.
Yes, if the loss of life wasn't grievous enough and that terrible figure of, you know, orphaning wasn't grievous enough, this is where the economists estimate that the really most severe impact is going to come. And there's been truly staggering numbers compiled by the World Bank. And I'm just going to reel some of these off because they're kind of mind-blowing. And, you know, I'm glad we're doing this mini-series on COVID because it just brings back the scale of what happened. In March 2020, schools closed in 180 countries around the world. That's practically all of the countries of any size, 180 countries. A year later, in March 2021, 12 months on, schools were either partially or fully closed in 94 countries around the world. So overall, 1.3 billion children in low and middle income countries missed at least half a year of school. 960 million missed at least a full year. 711 million missed a year and a half or more of education. And in the Latin American and Caribbean regions in South Asia, school closures went on for extraordinarily extended periods, 440 days on the trot in Uganda, 326 days in Saudi Arabia, 510 days in the Philippines. So children essentially cut loose from formal education for a year or more on an absolutely gigantic scale. And the impact of this is measurable in studies which are now being done in places as far apart as Bangladesh and Brazil, where there are huge deficits in the development of preschool-age kids and also school-age kids in the development towards language and literacy and towards in their mathematical capacities. And these are deficits in early childhood development, which are extremely unlikely to be made up at a later stage. the consequences of this for their job market prospects down the line are really, the word is staggering. The World Bank estimates that globally, a generation of students lost, and really just stumble over this number, $21 trillion in potential lifetime earnings. $21 trillion. That's just a staggering number. And it dwarfs, I mean, in economic terms, every other consequence of this pandemic, that we decided to sacrifice the education of an entire cohort of students to the protection of those most vulnerable to the disease, which is the elderly population. And unless those deficits are made good, everything we know from educational economics, these are no more than guesses and estimates, but nevertheless, everything we know from educational economics tells us that damage will go on echoing through the lives of literally billions of children for the rest of their lives, unless those deficits are made good. And there really isn't the sustained effort worldwide to provide that cohort of young people with the compensation, with the reparations, with the repair, simply, of their education that would be necessary to make good the deficits that accumulated in those critical years, early years of their development.
It's fascinating that you bring up the possible response of reparations. I mean, that is interesting to contemplate, because it does seem, in terms of education policy, it's hard to make up for this disaster. I mean, there's a sort of path dependence. I know in the United States, school absenteeism is a huge social problem. In other words, it's not just a one-time hit here. It's like even getting kids back into school now that they've been open for years is a problem. So maybe that itself will never be corrected, and it's not clear how it could be corrected. And then you're only left with the question of how to create reparations, I suppose, of some kind. But that, I suppose, leads back to the question of welfare state institutions that we talked about earlier. Yeah. The series on COVID will continue next week for a final segment. So definitely tune in then for that. But thanks for listening to us through this one. See you next week.
Ones and Twos is written and edited by me, Cameron Abadi, along with Adam Twos. It's produced by Claudia Tatey, Laura Rosbrow-Tellum, Rob Sachs, and Dan Efron. This show is made possible through the support of Foreign Policy Readers. If you're interested in news and analysis from around the world, consider subscribing. Listeners to Ones and Twos even get a 15% discount. Just go to foreignpolicy.com/subscribe and use the promo code TWOS at checkout. That's T-O-O-Z-E. And listeners, as always, we love getting your feedback. You can leave voice messages on the Ones and Twos homepage on foreignpolicy.com, or email us, podcast@foreignpolicy.com, or you can tweet us. That's @onesandtwospod. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll be back in your feed next week.
The first teller of my story is me.
This week on Disorder.
In this new world, when military power will be connected with high tech, small states can be very, very powerful.
Could small states help order the world?
Small states could be as effective, as dangerous as the big ones.
To find out, we're joined by Dr. Armen Sarkisian, Armenia's former president and prime minister.
In our two-part series, we discuss the history of the Armenian genocide,
the ongoing conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh,
and why small states could be the answer to the disorder in our world.
The big powers today have to compete in order to attract the small states to be their allies.
You can get Disorder wherever you get your podcasts, or you can follow the link in the show notes.